Welcome to Steam-Powered Scoundrels, a Malifaux podcast.
Episode 6, Amateur Fluffers.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty legitimate fear.
I don't know, mine is and always has been dying in a fire.
Hmm.
It's very specific, which is strange. Given that the first time I remember actually having this fear is when I was 3.
And welcome to the 6th episode of Steam-Powered Scoundrels. I'm your host, Doug.
I'm Victoria.
And our guest today is not Dave, he's back to being dead, is Sean Overton. Say hello, Sean.
Howdy.
Sean, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, my name is Clark, and I'm secretly Superman, and Sean Overton, also known as Shadow Opal on various forums. Basically, if you see a Shadow Opal anywhere, it's probably me. If you see a Shadow Pal, that's some other bastard. But what do we want to know about me? I've been collecting weird miniatures since before Malifaux was even a game. Back when they were just their Twisted line of minis. And following their painting competitions and all that good stuff. So I myself am a horrible painter, which is why I follow all the other painting competitions so that I can beat myself to death as to how few miniatures I have painted to any kind of a respectable quality. And Weird was very grand in their scope of very cool painters, so I started following them. And then they decided they were going to put a game out, and I was like, okay, cool, we'll check that out. And very soon after I got into the game, I stopped playing GW games, which is, I was an outrider for GW for years and years and years and years, and stopped playing GW games because of various financial responsibilities, and Malifaux was nice and affordable at the time. And
still is.
Well... yeah, for those of us who aren't completionists, I guess it's still affordable, sure.
I think it's always the exception, but going from zero to being actually able to play what would be considered a standard game is very cheap.
Yes, yeah, I mean, if all you're playing with is your friends, it's very affordable, absolutely. Especially since they made the mini rulebook free, you know, that took a big chunk out of the expense. So I think they're making moves in a more affordable path, which is great. I still miss the metal models. I like the weight of a metal model more than I do plastics. But, you know, I think they're doing good things with the plastics. So we will see where it continues to go.
I'll fight you on that a little bit. We're about a year and a few months into Malifaux, so we never had the metals. And some of the metals don't look the best.
I think that can be said of both. We can bring up Hamlin and his blob of goo if we want to talk about horrible managers. Fortunately, we're not doing Outcasts today, right?
So. No.
So, yeah, I mean, there's goods and bads on both sides of the coin.
I'll agree with you. The weight thing is pretty nice. And also, if you don't feel like actually painting them, you could see you're fielding an army of T-1000s.
Right. There is that. Metallic Malifaux models, yes.
So you admit to not doing Outcasts, so what do you play?
Well, that's a funny question. I do Outcasts. I have everything. I have all the Masters, so I can pretty much field a respectable force in any faction. Like I said, I'm a completionist. My wife frowns at my collection constantly.
My wife's a part of the problem.
That's a good situation to have and a bad situation to have, because I think that we would definitely not have a home if both of us were in the collecting aspect of things. So, yeah, but my primary force right now is Gremlins. I've been falling in love with them since all of the Masters are out finally. So,
why?
Why? Because they're awesome. Gremlins are the bomb, literally. Wong just blows stuff up.
By any chance, were you an Orcs player back when you still did GW?
No, I was not. I was Chaos and Demons.
Okay.
Actually, what got me into Malifaux was Pandora's crew, Baby Cade, because it followed along the demonic line of things. And Teddy, of course, the iconic model, the old metal model. So
I think Neverborn share the lines, have the lion's share of sort of draw-in models that make the game so interesting.
Well, they put them all over everything, you know. If they were to throw Guild up all over their advertising, I think Guild would do a lot better. If they threw Outcasts up all over their advertising, I think Outcasts would do a lot better. But when you look at the advertising of Weird, who do you got? You got Rasputina front and center, and you've got Baby Cade, and you've got Teddy. So that's what people are going to be drawn towards, naturally.
I think Pandora was the second box I got. She is still not painted.
Jeez. You were still indecisive of which faction you're going to do.
Terrible. Yeah, that's fair.
You end up going Rezzers, not Neverborn.
Yeah. I thought I was going to be way more interested in Neverborn, and then I got my hands on the Seamus box, and yeah.
Well, it's funny. Up until Gen Con, I had never played any Guild, just out of no interest in playing Guild at all. I picked up the Nelly box, though, and I was like, all right, this is in my wheelhouse. So I've been playing the hell out of Nelly and doing very well with her.
Of course you have. We've whined and complained about Nelly on this show.
So much.
Mostly about her sculpt.
Because of her face.
But now that I finally got my hands on the Wave 4 box, book. Yeah, she's a bit of a jerk.
It's a book.
She is. She is.
But yeah, as you said in your warehouse, I'm not going to make any judgments about you.
I will.
Judge away, judge away.
Well, if you ever get around to listening to her show, you'll know that I'm very much an Arcanist player, although I'm trying to get into Ten Thunders very slowly.
Don't do it. Don't do it. Ten Thunders are the gateway drug.
Gateway to what? Everything else?
Being Weaver?
Exactly.
It's okay. He's already that.
No, I'm not a weeaboo. Please do not give people the idea that I'm a weeaboo.
It was a joke. Oh, my gosh.
All right. Anything else that people might recognize you from, or you just want to plug for yourself?
Well, I do run all of the Weird events at Adepticon, which I'm sure is my main quote claim to fame.
What's Adepticon?
What's Adepticon? Oh, it's this.
I'm kidding.
It's this teeny tiny little know nothing upstart convention that, you know, it's only been around forever and only claims like 15 people. You know, it's a sad little spot.
Out in some backwoods town on a lake in Illinois.
Seriously, yeah, this teeny tiny little podunk town, you know. Freaking bi-wing airplanes flying into the airport, you know. There's nothing nearby.
Okay. Well, if you're done plugging yourself.
Yes, I'm done plugging myself.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
That does sound terrible. You might want to phrasing.
So we're going to get into the meat of this episode. I don't know how long this is going to go. Hopefully not too late, because you're tired.
Yeah, plus we've got the thing tomorrow.
But any of our dozens of listeners would be used to a format we used to hold where we do, you know, hobby and games played and all that stuff. And I realize that people probably don't want to hear about someone else playing a game. So we're cutting that out, for the time being anyways. And we're going to talk about fluff.
Thank you for not clapping.
I almost clapped.
It looked like you were going to.
I was thinking
and I'm like,
about it.
Anyway.
So, for, like, someone who doesn't know what fluff is, which, I know, it's kind
of... Who are you?
What?
Why are you listening to our podcast?
It can be a bit of a weird term if you're not familiar too much with miniatures. Anyways, fluff is the opposite of what you would really consider the game mechanics, how you play the game. It is the story that sort of makes the universe go round. They try to incorporate it as much as they can into the rules, but sometimes they'll clash a little bit. Fluff is your stories. You got a better description for fluff, Sean?
I think what you said basically sums it up, but it's the overall feel and the storyline and the little side stories that they're pitching to sell the universe as a whole. It's what GW has done so brilliantly for decades. All those novels that they come out with through Black Library, that's all fluff.
Oh man, that would be wonderful. Where to start making books?
We rant about that all the time on A Weird Place, yeah.
Print so, money. Well, maybe if they're going to be focusing on the other side this coming year.
Well, supposedly Nathan has rumbled that they're going to do books, but what is going to be in those books, whether it's just a reprinting of the fluff that's already in existence or whether it's going to be new material, we have yet to hear anything. Plus, there is, of course, the nondescript soon that everybody at Weird likes to use. So, you know, soon has been happening for years. As to when that will happen, who knows? But I hope it happens soon because, honestly, I love the miniatures, as I said, but the fluff is really what sold me on the game.
Yeah, that's kind of why we really got into it. I mean, I guess what the models are themselves is partially the fluff, and that was what drew us in, but the reason probably why we started this podcast is because we love the universe so much.
Yeah.
It's everything you've seen before, done before elsewhere, and also a bunch of unique stuff, kind of how they managed to mash it all together and still make it work.
Well, and that's the thing. The whole reason that they came out with Malifaux was because they had, you know, this mismatch of miniatures that they had done for their painting competitions and everything. And everybody kept saying, oh, this would be great to use in a game. This would be great to use in a game. Why don't you guys make a game? And they said, oh, okay, yeah, sure, let's do that. And so how do you make a game with this mishmash of characters? You make a fluff universe that embraces the mishmash. And I think they've done a fantastic job with that.
They've done a wonderful job.
Yeah.
And the good thing is, though, if you have a particular genre that you enjoy the most, they seem to compartmentalize that into the different factions pretty well. I mean, obviously, we have crossovers with certain models and stuff, but if you like your cowboys, you got your cowboy faction. You like your zombies, you like your steampunk, you like your anime.
Yep.
The Ten Thunders faction is actually not all that anime-y, if that's not a word. I made up a word, it's fine.
Yeah, I associate the Ten Thunders more with your the old kung fu spaghetti western kind of thing.
Mm.
Or like samurai flicks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But there's definitely some anime tones to things.
Yeah, and we're just making jokes about the anime thing because you know, someone might see it as a sort of GW's play with the Tau to sort of get that group of people into their game.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's definitely more of the feudal Japan, feudal China, just a lot of Asian stuff kind of slapped together. And that's just the stuff that's strictly Ten Thunders. And then you got the other, the infiltration aspect, which we usually refer to it as them being the mob.
Yeah.
But we are getting way off topic.
That's what we always do. We go off the rails. That's part of the podcast.
Every time. And so we're gonna try to just sort of gear our conversation towards one particular topic for each of these fluff sections. And today's topic, we're going to actually be talking about Earthside, specifically the events that happened before, after, and during the opening of the breach, but not actually on the side of Malifaux. Now, the fluff for this is basically in the starting rulebook and the starting player's guide for Through the Breach, the Faded Almanac.
Indeed.
I mean, it's Earthside is referenced often in other places, but any sort of like actual backstory is relegated to these introductions. Just sort of give people a bearing on what kind of universe they're getting into.
Well, and I think the Faded does a better job of the before the breach, because they go into, like, the Powder Wars and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who aren't buying Through the Breach books because all they want to do is play miniature games, if you're interested in the fluff, then I would definitely suggest picking up the Faded Almanac, because there's a lot of fluff in there.
There's a ton of it. There's a good amount of fluff in all this stuff.
Yeah, the Fate Masters I was actually a little disappointed with fluff-wise, but I don't want to distract. That's a separate topic.
That's fine.
because the Fate Masters is more of a how do you Fate Master, and there's very little in the way of fluff. There are a lot of conversion characters for playing with the Malifaux figs, but fluff wise, there isn't really a lot in the Fate Masters, which kind of disappointed me. But the rest of the book's made up for it.
Yeah. Well, if you just wanting, okay, yes, that makes sense. So you can avoid, you can drop the Fate Masters, but the Fated, the expansions into the Steam.
Under quarantine.
And into the Bayou.
Into the Bayou. The bigger Petty Dreadfuls also have a decent chunk of stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
It'll also explain where some of your Wave 4 dudes came from.
Yep.
So, since you're the guest, Sean, why don't you paraphrase real quick sort of the history of Earthside?
The history of Earthside. Well, basically, there was magic in the world. It wasn't really talked about in our history books, but in this alternate timeline that Malifaux exists, there was a little bit of magic that filtered into the world from somewhere, and they hadn't really figured out where. And finally, the mages all got together and decided to figure out where it came from, and they figured it out and teamed up to try and open a breach into this realm where magic comes from. And they did it at the expense of many, 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 many magic users' lives. And a whole town, in fact, got demolished. And I don't know if we want to go into that right now, but we do actually know where that town is. They don't talk about it in any of the books. It is in one of the Penny Dreadfuls. And that was only released just recently. So we only just got confirmation of that recently.
You go ahead and say it.
It is New Mexico, Santa Fe. Santa Fe is formerly, Breach Town is formerly known as Santa Fe. And the reason that we know that is because of a Penny Dreadful called Legacy of Darkness. And it's actually in the prologue on, I want to say, page 27. It's only available in PDF form on DriveThruRPG. But let's see.
And they also have, I noticed recently, they have a lot of one-shots out there.
They do. They do indeed.
I think like 14 was the last time I counted?
Yeah. Plus all of the little things that come with the box sets.
Yeah.
No, 27 was way off. What was I thinking? It's in the prologue. Prologue's like first couple of pages. Here we go. So that would be page, if you're looking at the PDF, it's page 9, but the book says it's page 7. So I was right on the 7 part.
Okay, so it's Santa Fe, and I'm not sure how much thought they put into doing that, or they just threw it out because it's very sort of stereotypical Western region. But we'll talk about that later. Moving on. Okay, they open up the breach, and then what happened?
So they open up the breach, and they find this other world that they go into, and they find this ancient city that has a mix of architectural styles that show that people have lived there before. And they develop the city and start finding this stuff called Soulstone, which helps magic out immensely. And they find these veins of it, and they start mining it, and they start shipping it back to Malifaux, or to Earth. And roughly, I don't remember the exact timeline, but eventually they run into some natives, and the natives aren't too happy with them being there. And there is a terrible battle that is heard through the breach, and the breach starts shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and everybody on Earthside is trying to figure out what to do. And eventually the hole is so small that a body, it just barely fits through it, and a body is thrown through the breach dead that has the word "ours" carved across the chest. And that is effectively the closing of the breach. And after that, we go into some other details, but that's the beginning of it. Do you want me to go through the whole overview, or do you want to take
that
chunk?
Go through the whole review.
Okay, all right, so I'll try to be more brief about things. So the breach closes, there's a period of strife Earthside where everybody's trying to figure out where they're going to get their magic from, where they're going to get their Soulstone from, because effectively it has been cut off. That's called the Black Powder Wars. All of the nations are vying for control over the few scraps of Soulstone that there are. And 100 years to the day later, after the breach is closed, the breach suddenly opens again, inexplicably.
Yay!
And they immediately make preparations to keep the breach open. They make this huge device that opens, that keeps the breach open and holds the energies in check. And they send an exploration team through. They find the same city, and the city is empty. There's no sign of anyone living there. There's nothing. It's, again, an empty city. So there is an organization known as the Guild. Those of you that play will know the Guild. And they basically take over the expedition of repopulating the city and expansion of their control of this new world. And they set up the mining operations and everything. So that leads us up to basically where we are today.
Hooray! All right. Pretty good on the description there. You've memorized this stuff. Are you reading out of the book?
No, this is just what I've
remembered.
Yeah, most of it's coming from memory. I mean, I flipped through the books just to refresh before tonight, so that I wouldn't be going, yeah, stuff happened and Malifaux, yay.
Oh, that's fine. You probably still sound smarter than us.
Yeah, you also seem to be under the impression that we're, like, a professional podcast.
We're going to check.
Well, you guys sent notes.
What?
You guys sent notes. You guys were, like, all notes and outlines, and I was like, wow, okay, I better shape up my game here.
Oh, sorry.
The notes aren't that great.
Shit, these guys actually expect me to know something. I better read the damn books.
The notes are to try to keep us on topic and
you've
to remind
seen
us
how
of
well that works.
Stuff we want to say.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start with the very beginning. So, Weird wants us to assume that this is basically our Earth, but some changes have happened. And the big change, obviously, is that magic
exists.
It was a really big thing back in the day, and it's starting to run dry. The well is starting to run dry. This reason, well, I brought up a couple questions just to sort of think about magic, because, you know, that's a big change. That could have really huge effects on, you know, how the world is shaped, but as you read more and more of the backstory, it seems like, you know, up until the breach is open, and even after, political lines are basically the same as what we have here in real Earth, I guess is what you call it.
IRL?
So, yeah, IRL. Right. So, first thing I figured was, like, well, that probably means that either A, magic, it doesn't really do a whole ton, or B, everyone has it. So it's not going to cause a huge power vacuum in one place or another. And so I'm assuming it's probably everyone has it because they were holding it up pretty highly as something that was really, really cool. And then you get into, well, what kind of magic? Because, you know, every culture has their own concept of what magic was or what magic is.
Sure.
And that varies very heavily. And I think Weird went with the answer of all of them. All of them work. If you go through the Faded Almanac and you look at the different ways you can be a magic user, there's a lot of references to sort of how magic was perceived in Earth and how you could manifest it yourself.
Right.
Yeah, and they've got all the different like magical theories, which are just different ways to make the magic work. So.
Well, I like that they just touch on Seamus and his, quote, magical theory in the Faded Almanac. And I'm not going to spoil anything. I'm not going to give away any weird IP secrets or anything like that. But the Faded Almanac, that little touch on how Seamus works was worth the whole book for me as far as I'm concerned.
So I'm going to assume that you're a shill for Weird.
That I'm a what?
You're a shill.
A shill?
It's okay, we're all shills for something.
I back things that I enjoy. And Malifaux is definitely one of the things that I enjoy. And I enjoy not only the fluff, not only the models, but the people who are involved in creating it. So, yeah, I could be accused of being a fanboy. I could be accused of being a shill. Sure.
No shame.
It's okay. I'm obviously not upset or anything. Back to magic. A couple other notes I had here I'm thinking is something we'll get into thoroughly later on is Weird seems to be very forward with its inclusion of women into its game.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with Malifaux, there is a lot of women in positions of power compared to probably what was the case in 1906 back in the day. And I thought this might sort of tie into this backstory of magic in that, you know, if everyone can use magic, it puts people on more of an equal playing field. So we're hundreds of years of, I don't really, how do I say this without being offensive?
Oppression?
Oppression. 100 years of oppression might have been lessened by the fact that, you know, ladies can also shoot fireballs and lasers out of their eyes.
Thing is, you could say the same thing about guns, though.
Yeah.
You would think the playing field would have been evened a lot just by the introduction of guns.
But this is saying magic has always been a thing since humans have been a thing.
Well, and here's the thing, is that you don't need money to buy magic. You don't need permission of a man in a patriarchal society to have magic. So
you don't need to have that to get a gun.
Well, there is that, yes. But I mean, we are talking if this were to happen in real world, you know, the whole reason that we had such a disparity between men and women owning guns was because it was a patriarchal society. I mean, let's be honest. You know, there were certain things that women were unfortunately not allowed to own and do and all of that. And owning weapons was one of it, so.
Yeah, no, I can understand that, but with that, wouldn't you think that maybe possibly also women wouldn't be educated in the use of magic? Because from what I understand, it actually takes some kind of training.
Not a school training. It's just knowing somebody. Or like I said with Seamus's thing, I don't know how much you read of the Faded Almanac, but Seamus's thing is definitely an intrinsic knowledge. He knows how to do it. And like I said, I don't want to go into too much, but it's something that somebody can have an innate knowledge of and learn it through either spirits or voices in their head or whatever.
Word of mouth.
Yeah, word of mouth, exactly.
The book actually mentions like gypsies, like the your stereotypical fortune teller lady being one of the last remaining people that can still use magic. We're just guessing here.
I know, and I'm just bringing up alternate thoughts. It's fine.
Yep.
Your classic like your Anglican wizards. Yeah, that fit it to a T.
Right. Yeah, the, what is it, the...
Eye magic? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. I'm assuming that in this...
What was the theory?
Oxford.
The Oxford theory. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
This is awesome! Oh, man, I'm having so much fun here. Anyways, okay, well, let's we got a lot of things to cover, and we'll probably dedicate an entire episode to women.
At some
and
point.
Me being awkward, so we can move on.
That would be awesome.
Next note, and I told you I should brought these up. I gave you a couple rules that we decided on before we were going to record this, and I don't remember what one of them was, but the other one was Weird doesn't make mistakes in their lore. Everything has a purpose, which is why I was like, they're not trying to be forward by having a bunch of women in positions of power in the game. This is how it was. They've always been this way.
Rule 2 was M2E models are canon.
M2E models are canon.
Yes.
First are not unless it shows progression of some sort.
Yes.
Like with Sonya Kryn.
Yes.
Right.
Because I would just like to never remember old Leviticus or Ophelia.
They don't exist.
Or Lady J, really.
Zoraida.
I like the old Lady J better than the new one. Sorry.
Apology accepted. Moving on, religion, something Weird has not touched at all, which is probably safe.
Smart.
Yeah, that's a good move on their part.
But we're going to take this as they did it on purpose, and it also makes a lot of sense. In this universe, magic's a thing. Everyone can start to have magic. So that kind of lessens...
any sort of
organized religion. I mean, going with the obvious one here, Jesus, all the stuff that Jesus could do could quite possibly be pulled off by anyone.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. We're using the word everyone, and magic was accessible, but I don't necessarily think that everybody had access to it. I think that people could potentially be trained to it, but even in Through the Breach, where all of the player characters are going to have abilities of some kind, they do state that not everybody who crosses the breach suddenly shoots lasers out of their eyes or frost out of their butt.
Snow farts. I was using the expression wrong.
I mean, it is accessible, but I do think that religion is actually an interesting thing to take a look at because, you know, those miracles are, you're right. Suddenly, you know, magic explains a lot of those miracles away. But the question is the magical theory belief in God, or is it belief in a higher power what actually grants the magical theory?
Or is it like strictly science?
Correct. Or is it just strictly, hey, it's magic, you know?
It's not, and we will get to that later. I plot twists going on.
And then of course there's the uncomfortable subject of, is God a tyrant?
Oh, jeez.
Oh, wow.
Okay, we're not going, we're skirting that.
We're not going to go into that.
I told you it was dangerous to invite me on the show. Because these are the things that float through my head.
Cool. We're just not going to touch it with a 10-foot pole. We can't afford to lose listeners.
We're moving on. I have the bullet point of talking about technology. And this is sort of how I sort of walk into what you just explained earlier, that not everyone has magic. Because if everyone had magic, probably technology would not have advanced nearly as much as it has for the Malifaux universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, was it need is the mother of innovation?
Necessity.
Yeah.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
And if you can just, you know, conjure up yourself a hamburger, there's a lot of things.
I want that power. Now I want a hamburger, so thanks for that.
Welcome. What's that, Sean?
Hamburger run. I don't know. That's one that I've toyed around with a lot because things like teleportation in Through the Breach are fairly limited in their scope. So you would still have the necessity of travel by faster means to progress technology. The human mind can only work so fast and so hard on certain things, so you would still have the necessity of technology for computation and those kinds of things. So would magic make us a lazier society? I would assume so, because we're humans and that's what we like to do, is make ourselves lazy and sit on our posh butts. But given that magic wasn't as proliferate as technology, because technology could be hypothetically accessed by the common man, even if they didn't have magical abilities. So it's one of those things that I could argue both sides of the coin. So,
like, even with a magical power, I don't know that you'd want to use it all the time, right?
Right.
Like, say I can just make myself hamburgers. Maybe someday I don't want a hamburger.
Well, and if my magical theory is scarification, you know, eventually I'm going to run out of body. You know, it's like, yeah, that hamburger's really good, but I just don't have that hangnail to rip off anymore. So,
oh, no. Oh, gross. Also, some of the magical
theories?
Yes, some of them are very limiting.
Yes.
As far as what you can do.
Yes.
So I could see where technology would still be a necessity, regardless of whether or not you can use magic.
Mm-hmm. And plus, soul stones, you know, just made technology even cooler. So there's that.
I think it'd be hilarious if magic and the use of magic evolved and became simpler, just like technology did. So you'd have, like, some magicians sitting around a coffee table and be like, remember when you had to sacrifice a dozen virgins to do that?
My role-playing group has actually had that conversation.
So. That's amazing.
Okay, moving on. The magic was a thing. So our Arthurian high fantasy sort of fiction we have could quite possibly have been a thing sans elves and dwarves. And that's, I think that's as far back as when it was probably at its peak, was, medieval ages.
Depending on the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It just fits in nicely with what we already have as pre-existing fiction for humanity. And then at some point, it just starts to disappear. Magic starts going away. And I had, two ideas why this is happening. The one that's pretty obvious, and the one that I sort of pulled from a different universe, which I thought was kind of cool. The first one is that magic is a finite resource. It is something that you can pull out of the air, or the ground, or something, but eventually it'll get used up like our oil supplies, and this is what was happening in the Malifaux Ursae.
Okay.
It just started running out. It took more efforts to manifest it. And the other theory that I like is that magic itself is sort of a denial and manipulation of physics, whereas technology relies on physics to make it operate. So in sort of a theoretical sense, they would abhor each other. So say technology kept advancing and magic started going away because it couldn't exist with so much, with more and more advanced technology.
Okay. I can see that. I will throw a third monkey wrench in.
Ooh.
Which is, we all talk about the breach as if it's the only one, but there is enough references in the fluff to warrant that there are multiple breaches. And therefore, I have the third equation, which is magic has been seeping through these minor breaches since time began. And these various breaches open and close at a set interval.
Okay.
So as the number of breaches that are open at one time waxes or wanes, magic
itself waxes and wanes?
Yes, exactly.
Sort of like our ice ages. Like large spans of time.
Right.
I'll add a 3.5 to that and say possibly something in the Malifaux universe closed all of them. At least for a time.
Hmm. Okay, sure.
That would make sense.
Catholicism.
Oh, geez.
Wait.
Cringe. Well, it would technically give the universe a sort of a big bad, possibly, besides the tyrants. Or maybe it was the tyrants themselves. But they hint at that the tyrants were died a long time ago, or were sealed.
Yeah. Yeah, and that could have been the event. You know, maybe that was the event that opened the breaches, and the fact that the tyrants have been slowly awakening, they are sealing the breaches again.
Wow.
That's another little monkey wrench we can throw in there.
Cool.
So yeah, I mean, the more I think about it, the more various ways I can come up with why magic exists and why it has slowly drifted off. But those are the ones that I like the most. Those are quote five, I guess now.
Jeez. Okay. So we move on to the opening of the first breach. As you described before, basically all of the magic users that can still use magic have a huddle, get in a circle, sing kumbaya, and then blow themselves up.
Yep.
To make this big blue hole in space-time.
Is it blue?
I don't think it's blue.
I think all the descriptions call it blue, yeah.
Hmm. I don't ever remember a color being described. Interesting, I'll have to go through and read again.
Or it might just be that Doug likes blue as the color of magic. Enough.
Well, I know it's always depicted as blue in the pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I'm building a portal for Adepticon, so that's that's a topic that.
What color is the breach?
We've been arguing back and forth on. So.
Well, color theory would be good because blue is sterilizing. It's alien, and it's not a color you often see in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Stargate.
That helps. Doctor Who?
Doctor Who too.
If all else fails, Stargate. Because aliens. I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
Very stretched.
Obviously it was aliens.
So, okay, we get into the where And as you said, they recently posted that it was Santa Fe, New Mexico, is where Breachtown is. And I have a bit of a problem with this, because Santa Fe, New Mexico, was barely a place people were living back in the late 1700s.
Yeah, and?
And all the fluff, it says it was like a city that people knew of and were gathering.
And I'm going to again say alternate history.
Yeah, but again, the thing is that it's like Earth unless they explain why it's not like Earth.
Well, and they never say it was a major populace. They say that there was a large gathering of people there, but that's because it was basically the Woodstock of magic. So, you know, you could effectively throw up what was back in that day a fairly major city if everybody just decided to commune and...
But you could take a major highway to get to Woodstock. This is, like...
Well, no one said it happened quickly.
Good point.
So, I mean, Santa Fe was in existence. You're right. It was not a very large populace at the time.
I don't know if it was still, if it was just a native town thing, or the Spanish owned it by then.
The Spanish owned it by then. It was founded in 1610 by Spanish colonialists.
Okay.
Colonists. Either way.
Right. And we're talking about 1787 as the opening of the breach. Yeah, I don't know. Do we have a Google on how many people existed in Santa Fe at 17?
I've got the Wikipedia up, but it does not say. It just says the city of Santa Fe, founded by Spanish colonists in 1610, is known as the oldest state capital city in the United States and the oldest city in New Mexico. And it has a population for 2012, but that's not going to help us.
Right.
Just the impression I was getting from the intros is that it was a major populace and also a city that was a good conduit for magic. So it being an old city in the U.S. is kind of nice, but compared to like an old city in Europe. And I never thought that the breach was in Europe, but I figured it would have been like an East Coast town or something with a little bit more access.
There was apparently quite a river running through Santa Fe until the 1700s.
Oh, duh. You know what would have been like really big magic users in this universe? Native Americans.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So there's your theory is that natives, especially like the populace around this time, the reason that it was, I don't want to say easy to conquer America, but kind of a little bit, was because diseases were just crushing them horribly. But with magic, they probably would have been able to cure these diseases. So you're looking at probably a much larger Native American population, and there was some sort of city of theirs. Yeah. So like the...
Well, and here's another thing for it happening in the U.S. I know that there are a lot of places overseas that have like these spiritual nexus, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
There is one, and it's funny because I actually, before they had talked about Santa Fe, I actually thought they were going to say Sedona, Arizona, as where the breach would be, because there is very well documented, they're actually called spiritual vortices, and there's positive energy flow and negative energy flow coming out of these things, if you're into all of that. So I was thinking, you know, that might be a possible venue. So the question is, you know, do we want to try and map out ley lines from there to Santa Fe and see how that runs, but
maybe later.
For a different episode. But yeah, according to the Wikipedia, there was a cluster of homes that centered around the site of the plaza today and spread for half a mile to the south and west.
Nice.
So it was quite a large Native American settlement.
Depending on how big their yards are.
So since people can't hear my eyes rolling.
So what did you think it was? Because I had a couple theories. One was Atlanta, because the connection with the company itself being being there. Also, I think in one of the more recent Breachside broadcast stories, they mentioned, they name a county that was they were pulling prisoners from, and there's a county in Georgia by that name. Although it might be spelled differently. Or Louisiana, because that's like one of the most magical cities in the United States.
Well, and I mean, here's the thing that I was thinking is that I know that they said it was by a large population of people, but they never really said whether it was. They did say that a city was destroyed in the opening of the breach, but they never said how big of a city it was. And I was thinking that, you know, if I were on this council of elders that wanted to open up a magical portal into another world, I don't think I would do it by my biggest city, you know, just in case it did blow up and flatten everything for a 50-mile radius, you know, because who knows? But So I was trying to keep away from, like, major cities and that kind of thing.
You know, desperation will drive people to do some pretty not well thought out things.
Sure. My whole thinking when I was looking for possible locations was next to rail lines or close to rail lines, making transportation to the site easier, as opposed to having to build a rail line to the location of the breach.
I have actually, I talked about Atlanta and New Orleans, but I didn't get around to going with my biggest headcanon, which is St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
which fits your rail theory pretty well, because it's one of the biggest railway hubs ever.
Right.
But also, it was a literal gateway to the west, which sort of the breach is a stand-in for, because once you go through to Malifaux, you're in the Wild West.
Right.
Mm.
And it's also temperate, because Malifaux has seasons, and not once has anyone complained about going from, like, 70, 80 degrees to below zero through this portal. I don't know what the average temperature is in Santa Fe during the winter, but...
Probably not below zero.
Probably not snow.
Yeah, I have to admit, I don't know much about Santa Fe.
I don't know Santa Fe exactly, but...
It's the hot part of the country.
I had a friend who lived in Phoenix, and he complained that it was really super cold when it got down to 40. So, I'm going to say it doesn't get cold in Santa Fe.
I think we've been...
You think we've been fixating on Santa Fe too much?
Yeah, a little bit too far down the rabbit hole.
If we're going to talk about something, we're going to talk about something.
Yeah, but we don't want to be here all night. Sean's a busy man. He's more important than we are.
Nah. My cats are fed. That's my responsibility.
Good. Glad you're feeding your pets.
That's always good.
So, okay, this council, all the mages get together, open up the breach, explosion, lots of people die, they freak out, send someone through, find Malifaux. It's great. It's wonderful. It's a decade of prosperity for all, because they find Soulstone and technology and new magics, and it's wonderful.
Until.
And then it goes to crap. All of a sudden, their supply of Soulstones is completely cut off because their access to Malifaux is completely cut off.
Indeed.
And then we get into a global resource war, which they refer to as the Black Powder Wars, which goes on for 17 years. That is a long time to be fighting.
That is quite a span of time.
Well, given that you've got the whole world involved, I would think that would be a conflict that wouldn't be very easy to get past.
How long did World War II last?
Right, but there we had two opposing forces, basically.
Okay, yeah, good point.
This would be country against country against country against country against country against country. So, I think the conflict would be a little more involved. Not that World War II was a small.
World War II was 6 years long.
Yeah. So,
I think saying it's a there was a lot more smaller conflicts that were going on that wasn't really a part of the, you know, us versus them, Axis Allies conflict that everyone likes to glorify, but that's still, most of it was pretty well focused. I think, the reason it went on that long is because it was very unfocused, and once you beat someone, you were still against everyone else, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Which actually makes a lot of sense for how the Guild came to power. They're the sort of the victors of this 17-year long hellhole.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the reason, because I have a question on here, but they are not a country.
No.
Basically a secret society, right?
I don't even know that it's a secret society. They basically just came out and said, you know, we have control of... They came together and said, we have a plan. to stop all of this conflict. They said, you know, there's a limited amount of resource. We are going to round up all of that resource. We are going to divvy it out to the countries in a controlled manner and, of course, profit in the long run. But, you know, hey, somebody's got to stop this. So they formed a central headquarters at the breach because they also basically predicted the reopening of the breach. They said, you know, hey, this can't last forever. We got to be able to open this again. So we're going to set up our headquarters here, and we are going to be the main in-out center for Soulstones when it does open up. But until that time, hey, why don't we all come together, be cool with each other, share the resources that we have.
Share.
Yeah, share. You at home can't see us making air quotes. And for whatever reason, the countries just kind of went along with it. They don't really go into too much why, from what I recall. I'm going to do a quick glaze here while you guys discuss.
I mentioned the secret society thing because they originally weren't like an out and open group. They just had a lot of powerful people in their pocket from different nations. I think that's probably how they could proclaim peace at that point, is because they have enough people willing to be with them that they could just say they could put down anything they really wanted to, except for the Three Kingdoms, really. But they had a lot of power in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
And once they gained control of Soulstone, literal and figurative power, nothing was really going to stop them.
Yep. That's basically what I'm seeing here.
I want to go quickly back to talking about Soulstone real quick, because I love this stuff. I love it how Weird has permeated this throughout all of the stuff they bring out. Soulstone is gold. Soulstone is oil. Soulstone is what you pay your crew with in the game instead of points. And even after you're done paying them, whatever's left you get to use in the game. It's awesome.
It works well as a resource, yeah.
Yeah. No, I like that it's very non-challenging to any nationality. Whatever, you aren't talking about the US dollar, you aren't talking about the yen or, you know, whatever. You aren't saying one nation has control over Malifaux. The guild is a separate entity that's made up of all of the various nations.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
They don't really have control over Malifaux either.
Nobody really has control of Malifaux.
That is true.
I want to sort of link back to what I said about magic abhorring technology. And this, in Soulstone sort of being the unholy pairing of the two, where it's contains magic, but it operates like a battery, which is technology. And here when Malifaux opened, people were sort of awoken to the idea of constructs, of automatons, that they could power with these things, which is both magic and technology. So the opening of the breach and the discovery of Soulstone sort of led to, they talk about in the books, basically I don't really want to say an industrial age, but a renaissance, yeah.
Aha, words.
A second renaissance, where we're suddenly getting magic back into the world, but we're also making leaps and bounds in our development of technology.
Sure, it's almost a precursor industrial revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the Black Powder Wars, we get into scarcity and circle back to the idea of religion. Once a person dies, they can repower any soulstone near them. And it's weird how Weird doesn't want to sort of address standard religion, but they basically make it clear that there is such a thing as a human soul.
Well, I think the existence of a soul is pretty...
If you want to go hard-lined concept of a soul, but there's... What? Go ahead.
I was just trying to think of the word. I don't want to say standard. It's pretty widespread, though, throughout the religions of the world, mm-hmm. is that there's some sort of essence that makes you human.
Besides, you know, the fleshy bits.
Yeah.
Well, and then there's some religions that, you know, believe that animals have spirits as well, or are reincarnated spirits of humans. So.
Oh, that would be cool if they'd said whether or not that animals could recharge Soulstone. Because I don't think they ever said that.
I don't think they've specified, no.
They have not. My RPG group has. We have a semi-evil character who is basically a rancher who raises animals to charge soul stones.
Huh.
Weird. That's weird.
I've got a different group, yeah. They're a little special.
I don't know. I feel like if you're going to slaughter the animal anyway, just for like meat and stuff, I mean, why not?
And that's his main argument when the town comes knocking on his door with pitchforks and torches and everything. He states that he's providing a service not only in food, but also in taking worthless soul stones and making them viable again. So.
I can see where there might be some moral ambiguity there, but anyway.
I like to talk about how dark it is that they go on to talk. They specify that it sort of becomes a business recharging Soulstone after the breach closes, where you just load up hospitals and prisons and all other places where death is common just to recharge these things. It's very bleak.
Yeah. No, in fact, there's pieces of Karis's backstory that go into that a little bit.
How powerful do serial killers have to be in this universe, though? I mean, really?
Well, look at Seamus.
Please don't hit me.
I'm not going to hit
you. You're swinging your arms around close to my face.
Perfect example. There's only, like, a character in the game that you maimed that was the epitome of a serial killer.
Yep.
Okay, no, I'm sad. Yeah, that's good. I mean, Malifaux normally is extremely upbeat and cheerful.
Right?
Yeah.
Bad things never happen. Only good things.
Only good things.
Sunshine, rainbows, and unicorns only happen in Malifaux.
Ah, oh, jeez. So Gil basically reigns supreme for 83 years. Yeah, 17 plus 83. And I don't really know what they do in this. They obviously have a very, very tight grasp on the use of Soulstone, both, you know, who can use it, who gets access to it. They sort of run the world, but they also don't run the world.
# Illuminati.
And my only example for this is that Ironsides hates them because they let whatever country she's from, I'm pretty sure it's the U.S., keep their laws instead of revoking them, which meant that her family was still slaves.
Yes. I'm sorry, was there a question there?
No, I was just...
Okay.
No, I guess I was
asking for confirmation that I read it correctly.
Yeah.
So they have a tight grasp on the Soulstone, but not as tight of a grasp on the nations of the world, which I guess weren't terribly upset in boundaries and stuff when those wars happened.
Yeah, I don't really think they want control of the nations. I think they just want their money. I think they're kind of cool with being the middleman, and, you know, I don't think they necessarily want to take over the world. I think they're happy with trying to maintain control over Malifaux and the Soulstone lines there. It's kind of a pretty place to be.
Yeah. Well, again, he controls the Soulstones, controls all the power, really.
Yeah.
I tried to make that a Dune reference, but I forgot what the particular line was, so... screw it. So 100 years, and then the breach reopens. People freak out. I believe at least in the Faded, they talk about they didn't go in for a couple months because they were afraid that whatever screwed them up the last time was going to come out and conquer all of Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, the guild spent some time shuffling troops into position to protect the breach. Or protect the Earth side of the breach, and once they felt they had a tight grip on that, then they started sending some expeditionary forces in.
And, yeah, we get to sort of where we're at now. Well, technically, where we're at now is 9 years after the reopening.
Dun, dun, dun.
Which, fun fact, it was exactly, not exactly, but 10 years before, from opening to closing, the first time. And where it seems to be building up to something big in the current timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if once we hit year 10, something's going to sort of shake things up.
Some sort of big bad or...
Yeah.
The other side.
Well, I meant on in Malifaux's side, but, like, the tyrants come up. Do you know of Schemes and Stones?
Yes.
Okay, so you know those guys. Well,
I know of them, as I said before. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, but yes, I know of them.
Sorry, that's what... And he opposed a question for... And someone else on A Weird Place opposed a question, like, what if Weird introduced a 8th faction? And from all that they've built up to, I would say that Tyrants might actually be the 8th faction.
I feel like having Tyrant models, just based on what they're supposed to be, they would all be, like, way OP.
Not literally the Tyrants, but we have people that have sort of fused with them.
Oh, okay.
As in what used to be, how Rasp used to operate, how...
So basically Scions or...
Yep. Oh, okay.
Or, yeah, gotcha.
Because Shenlong's also got the keyword. And
actually, a lot of the Avatar forms have the Tyrant keyword as well.
Yep. You could make a lot of models dual faction, and then they don't have to create nearly as much stuff for an 8th.
Yeah, I hope that they aren't going to make an 8th faction. I really do.
No, it's just for fun speculation.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the posts for, you know, dual faction. Which masters would you like to see be dual faction and all that? I think it's fun theory crafting.
That's kind of what we're doing here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, it's almost 50% of what we're doing here, yeah.
Second opening, last thing I want to point out is that, well, the first one was... Thank you for bringing up the Renaissance, because that makes a lot more sense now. The first opening was definitely more of the Renaissance period, where a lot of the people that were going to Malifaux were the best and brightest.
Mm-hmm.
And the explorers, and all the smart and gifted and wonderful people. Whereas the second time around, Guild's very, very wary of all the dangers, and so they just sort of dump the complete opposite.
It becomes the Australia of the world.
Yeah, it's the Wild West and Australia and Mad Max and... Well, Mad Max is Australia, what I'm talking about.
We're going to send all of our prisoners over there.
Desperate people, the prisoners, sort of lower...
Scum?
Not all of them are scum.
A lot of them are.
No, but they definitely wanted to have sort of a desperation and melancholy feel to the universe, and I like, and definitely make it kind of depressing Wild West and depressing Victorian London at the same time.
That was already depressing.
Super depressing.
I don't think you understand exactly how depressing.
Very depressing.
Anyway.
So yeah, they wanted people that, I mean, it was the Guild that set everything up this time. So they wanted people that were easy to control and didn't have a lot of self-respect and were easily quashed. And so who better to send than the poor and destitute and criminally insane to do all of our mining for us.
And it's worked out wonderfully.
Yes, it's been a marvel. And
everything has gone to plan.
So that's... sort of covering everything up until the now, at least Earth side, and yeah, I don't want to get too much into Malifaux because I'm not sure how much material we have, but a couple of things I wanted to bring up. One, I like that they allude to other breaches opening, how they explain that the Ten Thunders have their own. I don't really think that's a spoiler at this point, but it's fun to speculate. Like, in our history, like, all the people that have, like, gone missing and no one knows what happens to them could possibly have just fallen through a breach and ended up in Malifaux.
Yeah, and that's actually a big part of Through the Breach, is that you can start out as raised by Neverborn and raised by Gremlins, and it's like, okay, well, how the hell did that happen? And so they actually have a little backstory of a... Lass in the one shots where she comes from Ireland, but she fell through a mini breach while she was swimming one day and ends up being taken in by gremlins as a child.
Nice.
And so that's how she has the gremlin raised trait.
Cool.
So it not only talks about how the Neverborn raised and the gremlin raised happened, but it also talks about the little mini breaches, which I dig that concept.
Yep, and that's how Zoraida is, like, hundreds of years old.
Right.
She came through. I would like for them just in like a throwaway sentence in a story of some time, like pick out one of the many adventurers that had gone missing over the years in our history, and mm-hmm. just like their ship is like in the middle of like a valley or something.
Well, it does lend a lot of credence to the Bermuda Triangle. You know, maybe that's just one great big breach. You know, that nobody's figured out yet, and it's not as stable as the one by Santa Fe.
And it also kind of explains the Neverborn.
Mm-hmm.
Because the initial thing is like, oh, these things look exactly like our legends and demons and nightmares and stuff and things that go bump in the night. And instead of that being, oh, these are things that humans have thought up of, it, no, these are things humans have seen, because it's quite possible Neverborn came from Malifaux to Earth.
Right.
Through these other breaches. And these are just things people have actually seen.
Yep.
Let me complain about Santa Fe a little more.
No, I'm not.
Just
get over it.
Oh, it would gosh. Make... I want to point this out, because this is like the first thing I thought about when I heard it was Santa Fe. It would make what we think of as the early 1900s southwestern United States look completely different, because it would be huge. Santa Fe itself, or Breachtown, would probably be the biggest city on mm-hmm. Earth.
Sure.
And then all the surrounding area, there would be much bigger towns, and it would be a lot more developed than 1906. And I would think they would probably put the effort that was put into the Panama Canal to just sort of dig a trench through the Rio Grande and out to the other side mm-hmm. and connect it up to Santa Fe, because water travel is still a lot faster than land travel. And this is the most precious and important commodity on Earth.
That would make sense.
Well, it also depends on what soul stones do to trains.
What do you mean?
Well, you say water travel is still faster than land travel. So that may be true in our world, but when you put a soul stone into a train, what does that do to the speed and the... stability of the train.
You could probably do the same thing with like a ship, and it would just, you know, probably react in much the same way and boost it by
1906. Whatever. Both trains and ships would run on steam.
Yeah.
Oh, speedboat. Soulstone speedboat.
Well, and then you have the materials at hand, you know, because the boat would have to have some major reinforcement to deal with the water shear
mm-hmm.
properties of the increased speed. So,
yeah. Speed. We just get into overpowering technology with soul stones and another thing.
Yeah. Oh, I would have loved to have seen Tesla work with soul stones. That would be awesome.
Man,
I would love to see a Tesla Ramos sculpt variant.
Yeah. No, the Twisted Miniatures line has a Tesla model that I picked up.
Ooh.
For that specific purpose.
Awesome. I think I'm fluffed out. I don't know about you got anything more you want to bring up about Earthside?
I did a quick little search for the longest wars. 17 years? Not that long.
Like the 100 Years War?
There's the 100 Years War. There's several of them that have been going on for 200 years.
Technically, North and South Korea are still at war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So 17 years, really, not that long a war.
Yeah.
I was sort of in reference to a global
conflict.
Globe-spanning conflict.
And I was flipping through the formation of the Guild. So the Guild did come from a secret society. And right. It was one of the numerous secret societies that specifically did not participate in the opening of the breach, which is interesting.
That's what happened.
So that's why these guys were able to predict the opening of the second opening of the breach. So there you go.
Cool.
But once they became the Guild, they were out in the open and said, nope, this is how it's going to be. You guys can either deal with us or
die.
Yeah.
come at me, bro.
Exactly.
Got anything else you want to bring up?
Oh, no. I mean, I can babble on endlessly from 15 different vantage points, but...
Well, if you want to, we can have you back for another episode.
Absolutely.
I'm happy to return. I always love talking about the fluff, so.
Awesome. Well, that was crazy long.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll go to our segment, continuing segment, that we're about to run out of, and rank our Gremlin Masters, because Sean here is such an avid fan of the Gremlin faction. And that should not take an hour and a half.
Hopefully.
It won't.
Hopefully we won't argue that much.
Okay.
Okay.
The second segment of Steam Powered Scoundrels. Yeah, I cut you off. Deal with it. We are still here with Sean Overton, and we are going to go ahead and rank all of the masters in the Gremlins faction because he likes Gremlins.
I do.
And we haven't done that faction.
Is this the only one you haven't done?
No, we still have Ten Thunders.
I would have a harder time with Ten Thunders, I think.
Not really. Not for me, anyway.
I think my hardest was the Neverborn.
Good. Neverborn kind of steal the show.
Yeah.
For Masters, at least. That was our consensus.
See, then after you do everything, you should do a which faction, rate the factions as wholes. That would be fun.
Gremlins would probably be at the bottom of that. Be perfectly honest. Well, that's kind of not their thing, really, no. Is being super-duper powerful and stoic and inspirational. They're Gremlins. There's a bit of goofiness in everything they do. I guess except for Zoraida, but she's definitely the outlier of the group.
I don't know that you could even say Zoraida's got a pretty goofy-looking eye there. You know, she's got that old hag with the wandering eye syndrome going on.
She can't help it. Don't be so mean. All right, we're going to stick with the regular format. We will go around the table listing off our masters, worst to best. We'll just go with Doug, Victoria, and then our guest Sean will be the last one. We'll have discussion on all the masters when we get there. All right, for Doug, number 8, the worst. And it's kind of hard to rank these guys because they're a little bit different than everyone else. So this one was definitely a lot more of what I liked and what I didn't like, just personally. And the one master above all that makes me the most uncomfortable is Wong. I know what they were going for. It still makes me feel really, really weird. No, we're going to shut up and then we'll talk about
just
it later.
Shut up and read your list.
Number 7, Brewmaster. It's just a little bit bland. Number 6, Ulix. Number 5, I have 2 4s. Number 5, Zoraida. Number 4, Ophelia. Number 3, Ma Tuckett. Number 2, Summer Teeth Jones. And number 1, the newest and bestest Gremlin Master is Zip, the Sky Pirate.
Very interesting.
Very. Everyone says that!
It's because your lists are wrong.
I don't want to tell you you're wrong, so I'm just going to say very interesting.
That's how it works.
No, that's it. I will explain my very interesting after my reveal.
Cool.
Alrighty. So, my turn. For number 8, I also had Wong. I think he's the worst. Oh, yeah, I guess I might as well say, as per usual, this is just my opinion. I have no rules. Because that's just how I roll. It's just all based on what I like and don't like. Anyway, so 8 was Wong. 7, I have Ulix. 6, I have Summer. 5, I had Ma Tuckett. 4, I had Brewmaster. 3, Zoraida. 2, Ophelia. And for number 1, I also had Zip.
This is the part where you say interesting.
Interesting.
There we go.
Can I follow it up with an excellent?
Good.
If you want.
Or good. Good.
That is exactly how I wanted you to vote.
So I want to start...
Getting the fucking robot, Shinji.
I want to start talking trash as much as possible, so... We're going to go over to Sean. Sean, lay us some truth bombs on us.
All right. The truth according to Shadow Opal, which of course will piss everybody off.
Posting this to a weird place the second we're done.
Oh, weird place hates me anyway. That's all good. Number 8 is Summer Teeth Jones.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Number 7 is Zoraida.
Whoa. Okay. Hold on. We're actually going to talk about actually, this. Explain yourself, sir.
On which one?
Summer.
Yeah.
On Summer? This is strictly from a build standpoint. Summer Teeth Jones is one of the single most horrendous master models to put together.
Oh.
Yeah?
His face comes in 3 pieces.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah. he has gremlin feet and gremlin arms and gremlin hands, and therefore, having assembled the entirety of the gremlin army, I can say that gremlins is most likely the single most difficult faction to assemble, simply because all of the feet on almost all of the gremlins are separate. Almost all of the hands are separate. So
no, thank you.
It's a challenging faction to assemble. And Summer Teeth is, one of those that I don't like the pose. I don't really like much about the model. I don't use Summer very often. Are you looking to interrupt? Do you have a question?
I wasn't going to interrupt. I do have several questions.
Okay.
I was just going to let you finish, though.
Okay. Yeah, I don't use Summer at all. And it's one of those crews where I spent a lot of time, and I do think that his crew box also, unfortunately, has bled over into my hatred for him. And that is that all of the gremlins came in 15,000 pieces and the freaking mosquitoes of stupidity, just don't fit on the base. And so, yeah, I don't like Summer very much.
Every faction has one or two pieces like that.
Oh, sure.
I had to put together a brass arachnid. That wasn't fun.
Absolutely. But the thing is that with Ramos, you have the brass arachnid. What else do you have that's difficult?
I lost an arm on Howard. I lost a pipe on Joss. The spiders didn't really fit in quite well, so that required some drilling. Ramos himself was pretty easy to put together, I'll give you that.
Yeah. With Summer, every freaking model has a problem.
Yeah. You made that apparent, and I 100% believe you.
It's like, yeah. And, I mean, I have small hands, you know. I'll be the first one to admit that. I have small sausage fingers, you know.
I'm just going to put that on a weird list.
Oh, they've heard that before. You don't have to bother putting that on.
Small hands.
Yeah, me and Trump, you know, we'll duel. sorry, I shouldn't get political on a talk show. That's horrible. All right, so anyway, yeah.
Just a comment on the size of his hand. It's not...
So one question, because you're a much more experienced miniatures player than we are. Are the Gremlins the hardest faction of all? Not just Malifaux. As far as assembly.
Oh. Ooh. I don't know. I don't think so. But I would be hard-pressed to... Oh, no. The old Dark Eldar models back in 3rd edition. Yeah, those things sucked. I have more permanent wounds on my fingers from those little spiky bits than, and really anything chaos, anything with spikes. Yeah, I don't like spikes. But no, I mean, as far as like complexity of assembling models, I think the Gremlins definitely rank up there. And I do understand that every faction has their models. You know, yes, I've assembled the zombie chihuahua. Yes, I have assembled the brass arachnid. Yes, I've assembled the archers from the Ten Thunders. You know, I've done all that. But, you know, a faction of models that are intended to drive you insane is just... It's a challenge, yeah.
Very fitting for the ground.
All right, so that's why... I'm sorry, did you have follow-up questions?
Another follow-up question. Does the vintage model change your opinion at all?
I think... Well, I haven't assembled the vintage, so I can't say. Style-wise, I like the charging Summer a little better.
Really?
Yeah, but I like the... Honestly, we aren't talking about first edition models, but the first edition metal model is my favorite Summer model. the original one, not the alternate. It was a nice, characterful model where I think they've kind of gotten away from his character with the plastics a little bit.
I guess I'm going to look it up because I'm assuming the vintage one is the alt.
The vintage is, yes, that was the alt metal originally.
Okay.
Let me see if I've got a link that I can share with you. But
I'll look it up later.
Yeah. So more follow-up questions for that?
I'm good. You got an opinion on Summer?
I just kind of think he looks dumb. I mean, he's not at the very bottom of my list, but he's down there.
You heard it, folks. Summer looks dumb. Number 7, John.
Number 7 is Zoraida. And I can't really come up with a good reason why other than I understand why she is in the Gremlin faction, but then again, I kind of don't. So, yeah, I mean, to me, Zoraida was a gap filler.
They couldn't come up with 7 unique masters, so they threw...
That's kind of how I feel about it. And I mean, I realize they were doing a lot of things with the dual faction, and I kind of respect that. But on the other hand, we could have come up with something gremlin-y. But I'm okay with it. And the other reason is Zoraida comes with all those little voodoo dolls, which while they are very cool, you know, getting them all into their spaces is kind of a challenge. Plus, I always want to put her on the metal swamp base inserts, and putting plastics on metal is always challenging. So there's that. That's what I'm just saying.
I've had that problem.
That, and she doesn't have the saggy boobs that the metal ones did. So
yes, we're all missing
topless
grandma flabby bags.
Yeah. So
she's still pretty gross.
She is still pretty gross, and like I said, she does have that crazy eye, which you just have to paint it crazy. So. All right. So follow up questions on Zoraida, or should I move on to number 6?
I'm good.
Okay. Number 6 is Ophelia.
Oh,
that far down, huh?
Yeah. I think she's just too plain. It's too static of a model for my likings. One of the things that I really respected about the move to plastic was the dynamic poses that they were coming up with for a lot of the masters. And hers just feels very static. And yes, it's stoic. And yes, it's reminiscent of Perdita. So I get why they did that, but
it's to the character's detriment.
Yeah. So that's number 6 for me.
I like the stoic pose, I like the hair flowing in the breeze. I'm glad the hat's off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a bit plain, but I a lot of my argument for her and why she's higher on my list applies to Brigida. While I like dynamic poses, certain masters
don't need them,
or can have very simple.
Sure.
I wish she was pointing her gun. That's about it.
Honestly, what I really, really wish they had done, because I think she's a vast improvement over the metal.
No way!
So I that is one of the few models that I think is a vast improvement. But what I really wish they would have done was give her the gun kiss pose that they gave the alternate Perdita. I mean, that just would have tickled me and would have added so much character. So, but yeah, that's 6.
Okay. Yeah, actually, we did Guild right before this, and I actually thought personally that the original Perdita was better than the Gun Kiss one, but it would be flipping this. Actually, I would agree with you. I'd prefer the Ophelia to have that pose.
Yeah, that would be fun. I would like that.
Oh, you
yeah, I looked up the metal. Ugh.
So gross. You got anything on Ophelia?
Which one did we look up?
I looked up the medal.
Of Ophelia or?
Yeah, of Ophelia.
Yeah, it was not a great sculpt.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
And I mean, admittedly, that was back when gremlins didn't have noses and everything, so.
Well, they still, some of them don't. We'll just say it's a random mutation.
Yeah.
I think that probably makes Wong even worse. Anyways, what's your number 5?
Number 5 is, I actually had a hard time between 5 and 4. So I'm going to say that these two models are tied.
Okay.
But I have Ulix a little lower down than number 4. And that's just because of his freaking peg leg. Gluing that thing to a base is a travesty. So, yeah, there's that. And again, it's a model. I love the way he plays. I love his crew. I love Pigs. I'm all about the bacon. And his model just doesn't do much for me as far as, like, he's like an old cranky but fatter, you know, and I'd like to see him doing something a little more pig herder-ish.
It doesn't really give away what he does.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's just kind of standing there with his bow and his peg leg.
And his side eye. Oh, that expression's really creepy. I don't know if it comes out in the model, but the artwork.
Yeah.
Making me a little uncomfortable.
I would agree with that. So, number four is Wong.
Okay.
And I actually kind of like, when we're getting up to these upper ones, these are models that I actually kind of like, but they just have their problems. Wong, I actually kind of like the model. I like the fan. I like the three demon bag and all that. I like the fact that he has a Fu Manchu. That cracks me up.
Oh, jeez.
So, and I mean, you're going to disagree with me a lot on this, because a lot of the reason why I play Gremlins is I am not an overly competitive player. I tell stories. That's why I play games. I don't necessarily play to win. I play to be competitive and to give my opponent a good time. And that's a lot of the reason why I run Adepticon, is because I'm never going to win a tournament. It's just not going to happen. It's not within my play style. So, as long as everybody's laughing and having a good time, that is my ideal game. And so, you know, little things that tickle me, like the fact that the metal War Pig has Pork Chop Express on the inside of it. You know, the fact that Wong is a tip of the hat to Big Trouble in Little China, as is Bert Jepsen and
Gracie.
Yeah. You know, all those things, you know, they make me giggle, and that's why I play Gremlins. So that's why Wong's a little higher up than Ulix.
Cool.
So he's questions?
Got, yeah, a bit. He's got the pose is a little weird. I'm not a sensitive person, but it's one of those things where I would be kind of afraid to show Wong to people, just because there will be those shouts of, that's a terrible racist caricature and you're a terrible person.
Yeah.
I don't know, something about Wong just...
I mean, there's so much Wong about Wong that you know, you can't be white, so why bother? It's one of those things, it's like whenever I pull my Willy out, you know, and say, oh, you know, here's Willy, you know, it's one of those things, you know, you're going to get those looks and you just kind of deal with it, you know.
I make those jokes too. He's probably one of my favorite models ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing I had to complain about him is that the rest of his box is a lot more exciting than he is, at least I think.
Absolutely.
For the magician Gremlin, he's the only person that's not like doing magic. Compared, you know, to his Fireflies and Majiro. Majiro just draws the eyes really well. And we're not going to talk about the assistant. That's gross.
No, I would definitely agree with you on that. And the one thing that keeps it from being further up is the fact that they reused the sculpt for Wong. And it's like, okay, I realize that you guys did it in plastic and all that. But come on. Let's have an alt Wong somewhere down the line. So yeah, no, I would agree with that.
I'm all for alt models. Got any opinions on Wong?
No, not really. I mean, I did just say that something about him strikes me.
It's a gut feeling.
Yeah.
Who's your number three?
Ma Tuckett.
Ma.
I like Ma a lot. I like her box in that it is the simplest box to assemble out of all of the Gremlin Masters. So, yeah.
It's also all girls.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of girls. And I love her stance. I love everything about her model. It's very characterful. And if I didn't like the other two so much better, she definitely would have placed it. If Zip did not come out, she would have been she would have been higher on the list. It's just, you know, Zip is just awesome. So yeah, I like all of the models that are in her crew box. I like how easy they were to assemble. And, I like her sculpt. Like I said, it's so characterful, and it's like, you know everything about her from her pose.
I've been on the receiving end of Maw more than any other gremlin, in fact.
You said you have or you haven't?
Have.
Huh. Interesting. I don't see a lot of Maw players in my meta.
We've had probably have too many Arcanists in our meta. Yeah. Anyways. Probably. A bit.
Definitely.
My opinions on Maw, you basically hit the nail on the head. I mean, she's got a lot on her skull, but it's not terribly busy. She looks like a Maw. Mm-hmm. The idea of a motherly type figure running around smacking people with a giant wooden spoon is glorious. She's the biggest, I guess, sight gag.
Yeah.
Out of the Gremlin Masters.
Well, that and she brings Trixie. So
she brings Trixie.
And anyone that brings Trixie is awesome. So
jeez.
I think she's cute.
Aw.
Like little old lady cute, not like.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on before this gets awkward. Number two.
Brewmaster. Brewmaster was my number one until Zip came out. I love Brewmaster. I love everything about Brewmaster. I love his playstyle. I love his crew. I think he's just fun. And my brother is a craft brewer, so it's one of those models that just speaks to me on a personal level. I can just imagine my brother all wrapped up in dirty brown rags, hunched over and pouring ale into somebody's flagon. I mean, it's a fun crew.
Can't argue with personal experience. I had him low because I'm just strictly going off of what he looks like, and there's just not a lot there compared to a lot of the other masters and gremlin masters. It's just a dude in a cloak with a stick.
And a keg.
Okay, and a keg. I think I'm also a little bitter because, like, if they didn't want have to make the Ten Thunders connection and just go with whatever they thought of as a brewmaster, I think we could have gotten a really different and exciting sculpt, because that just brings to mind a lot of different things.
Interesting.
But they
so
like,
are you thinking a German kind of feel to the brewmaster? Or?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Not knocking Asian anything. It's just, it feels like, I already said as much as I can. I'm not going to describe it well, and I'm just going to be confusing.
Well, and, I really like the story of the brewmaster and Von Schill in their drinking contest. So that added a lot to the fluff and feel for him. So
did they fully explain the rules to Bullet?
Not in the story, but in Into the Bayou, you can actually play Bullet.
I want to learn the rules and then play with some Nerf guns.
Sounds good.
That sounds awesome, right?
Indeed.
You got water pistols. Brewmaster?
Not really.
All right.
I mean, I had him somewhere about the middle of my list, so I don't think he's awful, but...
I like all the little dangly bits that they put on him, all of the bottles and, you know, the things that are hanging off the staff. I think that adds a lot of character to him. And while, you know, he's not in an action pose, he's not in a very dynamic pose, he's in the pose that I really kind of equate with him, which is, come at me, I'm gonna mess with you, you just don't know how. And so I think his model speaks a lot to his play style.
Ooh, or they could dress him up like a classy bartender. Or the gremlin idea of what a classy bartender is. It sort of looks like he's stirring with his staff.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of what I dig about it is, I love the, what are they called? Not the wandering, the fermented river monks, you know, because they're all tip of the hats to the drunken master. And, that's kind of where I want the brewmaster to be, is he's the guy who keeps the drunken master charged. So that's kind of what I like about him. Anyhow.
Number one.
Well, of course it's Zip. I mean, you want to talk about a model that just oozes character and just ridiculous, asinine stupidity. I mean, it's...
So is the gremlin's gremlin? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, he really is the epitome of the gremlin faction. Just totally, totally ridiculous. Both in playstyle and fluff and... I said both, but, you know, it just... the model itself is fun. It goes on the base well. You know, he's got his Flash Gordon ray gun and his Flash Gordon jetpack and even the silly helmet, you know, everything about it. And I keep calling him Zap Brannigan. So, you know.
Is there a lot of Flash Gordon references with him? Because I was getting a Rocketeer impression.
Well, yeah, definitely Rocketeer too. But I mean, Rocketeer can really draw back to Flash Gordon. I'm not sure who inspired who, you know, they're both kind of in that same era of vintage sci-fi, ridiculous props and all that. So, and, you know, I'm a big old movie buff. So yeah, Zip is on my favorite for a lot of different reasons. Plus the Iron Skeeters are just ridiculously stupidly effective. And, so yeah, I like his box a lot. The only thing that I don't really like in his box is his totem. But I think that's just because I haven't figured out how to use him yet.
Earl?
Yeah, Earl. I think he's almost superfluous, but I haven't played enough games with him yet to where I figured him out as to if he's within my wheelhouse or not. I tend to get the first mate stuck out there, so I haven't decided if I'm going to keep running him or not. But the free upgrades for Sky Pirates is just hysterical. Dropping pianos on people, it's ridiculous. So
how did the Iron Skeers go together?
Not bad. Not bad at all. Yeah, I don't think I had a problem with it. No, take that back. the big problem that everybody has with them is there's one where if you don't take a look at the instructions or do some serious planning beforehand, you can leave a part out that it's the yoke. It's supposed to go inside of the head, and I almost left it out. So I've heard a lot of people griping about that. But the legs are all, you know, it's not like the regular Skeeters where you had six different legs on six different pegs that are all shaped in a specific way. And if you don't put them together, then they don't go together. So I didn't really have a problem with them, but I think the main problem that people are having are the clear stand things, the pegs that
flight bases
make them look flying. They are very hard to get a good attach point on the Skeeters, and they don't have a groove on two of them. They have it on one of them, but not on the other two. And that one is very firm on the stand. The other two, not so much.
I will give you $5 if you take one of them and you glue the flight stand to the top of one of the Gremlins' heads.
So upside down?
Flying upside down. That seems like a very Gremlin thing to do.
You don't even have to give me $5 for that. I'll do that. That sounds like fun. I can do that.
Send me pictures then.
Yeah. Sure.
We're getting off topic. I first want to say, First Mate is way too cool looking, and I would always want to play him if I was a Gremlins player. But Zip sells it for me in the pose, and the pose only. Well, I mean, his outfits is kind of cool, but if he wasn't poofing off on a blasting off, again, Team Rocket style, firing his, you know, zap gun, it wouldn't be cool.
Yeah. No, he is definitely the coolest pose out of all of the Gremlins. I mean, hands down, there's no debating it. It's like I think about Brewmaster, I think about Ma Tuckett. You know, it's like I said Ma Tuckett is my favorite just because of the pose really encapsulates her, and it's true. But Zip's not only encapsulates him, but it's just an awesome, awesome pose. Plus he's new.
Plus he's what?
Plus he's new.
Yeah. Oh, that nice new car smell.
Yeah, exactly.
There are certain models in the game that you want to show to other people just to show how cool the game is. And I think Zip really does it for the Gremlins.
Yeah, definitely.
Zip is best Gremlin.
Was he your
favorite? Yeah, I think we all agreed on that.
Was that the top for you?
Zip.
Oh, okay. That's what I asked, and you said no.
Oh.
I think that's the first time we've all came to the same conclusion.
I think so. Where everybody has the same as their number one? Yeah.
Maybe Vintage Raspy?
No, because Dave didn't put Vintage Raspy at the very top, I didn't think. I mean, I can go back and listen again.
We can go back and listen. All right. I think we're good. It has been a wonder talking to you, Sean. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, we'd like to have you on again sometime, but it's getting late. We would like to get some sleep. And you probably have stuff to do. You're a very busy and important man with very important business things to do.
Actually, sleep sounds like a really cool plan. I think I'm going to go dig on some sleep.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much. And we'll talk later.
Hi, everyone. Sorry, but we're only going to have two segments this time. The first one ran really, really wrong, if you couldn't tell. We're going to start dedicating a chunk of this podcast to Malifaux Fluff. This means that we want your help sending in suggestions for topics you want us to cover, and corrections for when we screw up. We'd also be happy for anyone to come in that wants to lend their voice to the podcast, as we always like having guests on the show. Now, it's time for us to close up shop, and remember, fun is always king. Have a good one.